podcast this week, we have the higher ground as Obi-Wan himself, Ewan McGregor, drops by to talk about his new show, Long Way Up. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. I can't believe it wasn't cast as the new Jack Reacher. Just 1 foot short and 150 pounds shy. So close. So close. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast this week. I'm joined, as ever, by three colleagues of such lethal cunning over Squadcast. We're not meeting in groups of more than six, that's for sure. Not this weekend. Oh, no. Anyway, those colleagues of such lethal cunning are our geek queen, Helen Idaho. What's that mean?
Well, it was a reference to Duncan Idaho.
It's a Dune reference.
Christ almighty.
Everything's a Dune reference this week, Chris. Come on.
Oh, yeah, isn't it? Isn't it? It is Helen O'Hara. How are you?
I'm good, and I'm just realizing I really should have called myself after the Reverend Mother, but, you know, because she is actually called Helen.
Helen Mohaim.
Yeah. Oh, well.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
I know you were going to say it, Chris. I know you were going to pick me up on it. You're such a big Dune fan.
And, I am such, and especially after watching that trailer. I am such a big fan of Dune, and it's one color. only kidding. It's on the cover of the New Empire right now. Go and pick it up in all newsagents, good and evil. Yay, Dune.
Yay.
Next up, it's always a delight to see our nerd emperor. He has returned to the podcast. No Dune reference in his name. He has called himself Inspector Javert. It is, of course, James Dyer.
Yes, that's nerd Padishah Emperor to you, Chris.
Oh, dear God.
You set this up. You should never have given him the title of emperor. It was obvious. I argued with you at the time.
I don't think I did.
Yes, you did.
You absolutely did.
And yeah. I said it was a bad idea, and here we are.
It is now legally enforced by my sod alcohol.
I don't know. James revealed to me in February that he was the emperor, and I just sat in that information for 7 months.
All right, Woodward.
Yeah. I am a one man Bob Woodward. So in other words, Bob Woodward. Anyway. The rotating fourth chair this week is occupied for the first time in a long while by... that's an incredible Tash. Yeah. I'm saying that he has the best... You can see this. We may take a screen grab and put it up on the Instagram after this.
It's what the people want.
In lockdown, I have had the pleasure to watch Alex Godfrey's facial hair go from... You know, little acorn to mighty oak. And look at that. You look like you're in Reno 911 on Quibi. Alex Godfrey, hello.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, I never saw myself as a man with a moustache, but it's just happened. And
it's just working for you.
I have to say, are you ready for it?
Yep.
It's kind of growing on me.
Hey!
James, why are you Javert today just because of your lifelong Les Mis fandom, or is it because...
Well, also because we are reviewing Les Mis today.
Yeah.
So I am Inspector Javert, who, as we all know, is the true hero of Les Mis. So, you know.
Fallen hero.
Anyway, before we get into the show, I should mention that, yes, we're not quite on lockdown here in the UK, but restrictions are in place preventing groups of more than six, or they will be as of Monday, preventing groups of more than six from meeting up, unless, of course, you're going to school or the workplace or your football team
or fine.
Going to races or cinemas or, you know, it's slightly unclear. Shall we say. But some people did ask what this means for the live show that we are doing on September 24th, just 2 weeks from now. I should probably get to work on planning that, don't you think? 2 weeks from now at King's Place, as part of the London Podcast Festival, King's Place, which has been our spiritual home for live shows over the last 3 years or so, they asked us to do another live show, and we agreed. And, you know, King's Place, as with many events, venues across the country, are having a bit of a tough time at the moment. And so we're doing this to help them out and to raise money for King's Place and so they can keep going as well. So with that in mind, and with the caveat that things can change, the live show is going ahead. It does seem to be the restrictions are in groups of more than six. So six households or friends, groups of more than six, but 100 people or so can be in a room. The live show will be absolutely socially distanced. We have been told that. The reassurances have been made for our safety and yours, of course. We will be there on the night. Team Empire will be on stage. We will be socially distanced, and the venue can hold around 100, 110 or so people in the audience. And tickets for that are on sale right now at kingsplace.co.uk, and we would love to see you there safely. Of course, we would love the buzz that a live audience brings. But if you don't want to go to see the show in person, there is a solution. There is a live stream of the show, which you can also buy via the King's Place website, kingsplace.co.uk. And you can stream that no matter where you are in the world. And you don't have to watch the show as live. If you buy a ticket for that, you have a 72-hour window after the show to watch the live stream. And we will say as well that will be a one-off show. It will be a totally one-off show. It will not be appearing. Initially, I thought it was going to be that week's podcast, but it is not going to be that week's podcast. So if you want to see or hear that show, then your only options are in person at King's Place or via the live stream. And we promise that it'll be worth your while. So if you've never seen a live show or you have seen a live show and you want to come back and experience the Bedlam, then I would heartily recommend that. And there will be a different recording of a completely different recording of the podcast up that week, which we will do earlier in the Blue Peter Classic style. This is one we made earlier. So there you go, kingsplace.co.uk. But first of all, let's get into the show itself. And we are up against it a bit for time this week, so we may not do the film fact section, much to the sadness of Helen and James.
Shame.
I know.
Oh, wow.
I'm devastated. I know. Chris, it's not fair.
I see how it goes, James.
Let's not protest too much, James.
If we have enough time at the end of the show, we will do the film fact section. Cut to James now filibustering for the next hour or so. Oh, sorry, guys, we don't have time.
It's a shame we're going to be talking about Dune at some point in this particular
Jesus
episode.
Jesus Christ. You've timed this to perfection, haven't you? Some sort of Machiavellian genius. Oh, sorry, guys, we've got a hard out, plus the Dune trailer is out. So we're going to start instead with the listener question. That is sacrosanct. That will always happen. And this week's listener question comes to us from Edward Llewellyn on Twitter, which is nice of him. And he asks, I've been rewatching Heat, and as Michael Mann remade it from LA Takedown, what film by the same director would you like to see remade?
This feels a lot like what films did directors fuck up, which we'd like to see them take a second pass at.
David Lynch's Dune.
David Lynch's Dune, yes.
No, but that would be amazing.
It would be amazing.
No, he wouldn't. It wouldn't. It would be just as terrible the second time because he's not the right man for the job.
That he's disowned that film because it just wasn't his film, really.
Is it in the same way that his version of Empire Strikes Back would have been an unwatchable morass of nonsense? Oh.
Never have made it. That's why he didn't make it.
And it was Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
It was Return of the Jedi, you're quite right.
But David Lynch now, 2020, given all the money in the world to do what he wants with Dune would be insane.
Yes, in the worst way possible.
No, but he knew he didn't have the time or the space or the money to do it properly, and he did his best, God bless him. But now maybe we could, I think it could work.
No, I think Denis is the man. All hail Denis. Hashtag Team Denis.
Obviously, I'm Team Denis. I don't feel like these are contradictory positions, honestly.
No one needs a sort of 57-hour Twin Peaks to Return-esque take on Dune. Feed me to a sandworm.
Hours. Yeah. Did you see Twin Peaks Return, Jimbo?
Yeah, I watched a chunk of it, yes, okay. Until I realised what it was, and no. No, what I'm going to put forward is J.J. Abrams, I think, should be given a second pass at The Rise of Skywalker. Now, while I hate to be a one-man Reddit thread, it does feel a lot like, there's a lot of subreddit action saying J.J. should, get a take two on this.
Why? But he did it already, and it wasn't that long ago, and it wasn't very good.
Yes, yes. This is what I'm saying. Give him another chance to do over, a mulligan, have another go, see if you can get it right this time. Now, this is obviously slightly relevant to news where Daisy Ridley has said that a number of people, including the four of us, were considered as Rey's parents in the film. And they kind of seem to have pulled Palpatine out of their ass at the 11th hour. So that, it's
painful at the best of times. Yeah.
Maybe shines a light on the film. I mean, to be fair to JJ, he did come. He wasn't supposed to do it. He was parachuted in at the last minute. So maybe he had a lot less time to work on this one. But I think we can all agree it's not the film we wanted it to be. And I love JJ. I think he did a great job with The Force Awakens. I believe he has a great episode 9 in him. I would like to see it.
Yeah, that's a good shout, actually. And obviously her comments tie into John Boyega's comments the week before, if you saw that interview in GQ, a fantastic interview. It really sounds like the film was made amid chaos and decisions were made as a result that maybe were not optimal for the characters, let's say.
And hey, while that could be applied to every episode of this podcast, clearly it didn't work as well for them.
I wonder what he thinks of the film, though. Maybe he felt that he was making the film he wanted to make.
Maybe.
Sure.
But I don't think, the thing is that JJ, I think, like maybe Spielberg, is one of those guys who wouldn't necessarily let his ego in that sense get in the way of the audience to a degree. Do you know what I mean? I feel like if, knowing what he knows now, he probably would make a different film. Because he knows that that's not what the fans wanted.
Knowing that he's made a ton of bad decisions he would make.
Yeah, kind of.
All right.
Like, I'd also give him a do-over on Star Trek Into Darkness and maybe with a, you know...
Star Trek Into Darkness is absolutely fine as it is.
Oh, my God. It is not.
I will defend that film to my dying day.
It really is. Let's give him a do-over in Super 8 while we're at it.
It is an absolutely fine three-star film. Don't knock it.
Let's give him a do-over in 3 of the 5 movies he's made as director.
Including the best Mission Impossible. Yes, that's true.
That's
but though we did mention Spielberg briefly there, I do think another pass at Crystal Skull, the film that, of course, is not an Indiana Jones film, would maybe be worth his time.
Never
you can't
heard
have a second
it,
pass at a film you didn't have a first pass at.
Yeah, it doesn't exist.
Such a shame that Hitchcock never got to remake The Man Who Knew Too Much.
He should get a third pass at it.
Maybe this time he'll get it.
Why
Talking
not?
Of which, I think Gus Van Sant should be made to remake Psycho again. And now it is his film, right? That is a Gus Van Sant film called Psycho.
It is, yes.
He should be made to do that maybe every year.
Until he gets it right, damn it.
take out the wanking for a start.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
That's what everyone tells me before the podcast begins as well.
Yeah, we've been trying that for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a thought that what I would really love to see is Richard Stanley being given the chance to make The Island of Dr. Moreau the way he wanted to make it.
Terrible experiments.
Yeah. I mean, maybe this doesn't really qualify because the film that was made does not have his name as director. But, you know, he was thrown off very early on during the shoot. And the dreams and the vision he had for that film were really interesting and really exciting and really bizarre. And obviously they made it up. They ended up making a complete mess of it. But I think he's still sort of hung up on it all. And I'd love to see what he would really do with that now that he's had some success and has some currency again.
Similarly, I'd quite like Gareth Edwards to get a chance to actually direct Rogue One. That would be nice.
Well, yeah. Or if we're talking real fantasy stuff, Lord of Miller's Solo, I'd love to see that.
Well, quite,
Lord Miller's Solo, yeah, for
Paul
sure.
Paul Verhoeven directing Arnie and Crusade, but we're kind of getting away, I think, from what the question is. I mean, for example, I would love to see somehow Zack Snyder given a chance to release his version of Justice League, but I don't
and
know if that's
happened,
ever going to happen. It's never going to happen.
That said, there is an argument to be made for Zack Snyder being allowed to redo all of the DCEU films and do them well. That would be perhaps a good thing to do.
Wow, you should probably change your name, identity. Go into hiding. They will find you.
I would be interested in, I mean, it doesn't work now timeline-wise at all, obviously, but I would be interested in seeing Louis Leterrier having another crack at The Incredible Hulk.
What, with Ruffalo? Bring Ruffalo in and redo Incredible Hulk.
It's not going to happen for a billion reasons, but I still am convinced there was maybe half of a good film in there trying to get out, and it was sort of stampeded, and I'd like to see what that might have been.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good shout.
Yeah, there is a film. There's a great film in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Buried very deep.
Very deep within. Very, very deeply buried, but...
Yeah. Buried under a lot of CG.
It is. I'm surprised no one's mentioned, perhaps topically, The Godfather Part 3, which, of course, is getting a chance to be kind of redone to an extent, isn't it?
As is Rocky IV.
Yeah. I mean, Rocky IV doesn't need redoing, but The Godfather Part 3 arguably maybe could do with it as a finessing.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that on the podcast. Okay, so there's two.
No, we haven't.
And this is a very, very good opportunity to do so. And then I should also explain exactly what LA Takedown is in relation to Heat, in case people don't know. But, so first of all, the first one that was announced was Stallone has announced that he is going to do a director's cut of Rocky IV. Now, you might say to yourself, hang on, But Stallone's the director of Rocky IV, so therefore isn't the cut that's been out there since 1987, isn't that the director's cut? And apparently, no. So Stallone is going to redo the director's cut. I don't know what great bits of footage are out there that weren't put into the movie in the first place, whether there's more of him running up a mountain, whether there's more of Apollo Creed, you know, before he dies. Who knows? But the one thing that Stallone has said is that Paulie's robot is going to be excised from the film. I mean,
people are going to be devastated.
Poor old Paulie's robot. It's gone.
I have a feeling that he is just trying to remove all the ridiculousness from this film, which would seem to... I mean, what are you left with?
Seriously impact the runtime.
Yeah, exactly. What's left?
His director's cut is basically like 12 minutes long. Oh, come on, don't diss Rocky IV, Chris. You love it. Just give yourself a pep talk. Yeah, it's great. Rocky IV is really, really fun. But what's he going to do? Is he going to make it more serious? Is he going to add another montage that's 25 minutes long? What's he going to do?
I think he is going to make it more serious. I didn't see the last Rambo film, but from everything I heard, it was deadly serious and deadly awful.
Hateful.
I guess he's in this day and age with all, you know, with R-rated films being more successful. I wonder if he's just going to try and make this more somber and take all the nonsense out of it. I mean, it sounds about what he's doing.
And there's a tonal disconnect between Rocky IV and Creed II. And Creed II is a direct sequel of sorts to Rocky IV. And Creed II is much more serious. And Rocky IV, as we said, has a bit with a robot and really cheesy 80s music and loads of montages. The film may be one giant montage. I'm still not entirely sure on that.
In a way, all films are one giant montage. So,
aren't they really? When you think about it? Yeah.
Really?
Isn't it? Magnificent small boys, jumping some goalposts in the park, flying, isn't it?
I don't even know what's happening at this point.
Rocky IV. He might be re-editing it so it falls in line more with Creed 2, potentially. But also, this week, or last week, Francis Ford Coppola announced that he is going to have one more go at Godfather Part 3. And it's going to be called Godfather Part 3, Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone. Which is originally the title of the movie. That's what they wanted to call it back in 1990. Not the Coda bit, but the Death of Michael Corleone is what they wanted to call it. And again, this is an interesting one. He kind of did the same thing, didn't he, where whenever The Godfather and Godfather Part 2, he re-edited them into chronological order. I think it was called The Godfather Saga, and it aired on TV.
Bad experiment.
Years and years and years and years and years ago. And so he's going back. He's now in his 80s, Coppola, and he's going back in and he's fiddling with this. And you wonder again, what footage is out there that wasn't in the first one? Unless you can somehow rewrite the script, get Robert Duvall to accept an offer to play Tom Hagen, make Tom Hagen the major player that he was meant to be in the original movie. And then that completely changes the movie. And then maybe, if we're being uncharitable, replace Sofia Coppola with someone else. So you get the mocap suits out. I don't know what you can do to this.
Winona Ryder was originally cast in that role, wasn't she?
She was,
and she
yes.
kind of still looks the same, I have to say.
If we're looking at tonal shifts, maybe he's doing the opposite of Stallone. And maybe he's going to replace every instance of Internazionale Immobiliare with Nando's.
I thought you were going to say he's going to have Paulie's robot.
With a robot, yeah.
Paulie's robot will return as well. Yes, clearly that's going to happen.
I would genuinely love that. If at the end of the movie, you know, Michael Corleone's going, "It's not what I wanted!" And, you know, there's a robot. He's going, "Michael, happy birthday, Michael.
I didn't want this robot. Get this robot out of here."
And the robot kills Michael Corleone, hence
yes. It does, yeah.
Hence the title. That's
the, and then, and the robot's called Coda.
Or the robot just replaces Joey Zaza.
Leave the gun, take the cannoli. No, wait, I got it wrong.
Whatever it is. What's the word? What's the line?
It is
anyway.
Cannoli.
Leave the gun,
I believe,
take the cannoli.
In America.
Oh, I want to see that now. I want to see the entire Godfather saga remade.
Look what they did to my boy. Look how they massacred my boy.
That would be tremendous. Get on it, Coppola. Anyway.
Cool.
Maybe that's what's happening. Maybe that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah. But do you think Godfather 3 can be saved?
Yes, because it's fine as it is. Like, it's nowhere near on a level with the first two, but it's not a bad film by any stretch. I maintain that it's much maligned. Clearly that's
just a home.
Clearly that's like popular, one of my more popular opinions.
It just doesn't, it didn't ever need to exist. That's the problem with it, isn't it?
No film needs to exist, though.
No, but decades later, or whatever it was. Actually, it wasn't. It seemed like decades, about 15 years later. But it just didn't, when it finally came around, it didn't have the weight and the currency of those other two. It seemed too late, and it didn't have the power of it. And I mean, look, James might be right. It might be, it's a perfectly serviceable crime film, but it doesn't feel of a piece with the other two. So
yeah, it's not an all-time cinematic classic, certainly, but it's a decent film.
I need to go back and re-see it.
You do?
I do. Yeah, I really do. Me too. But maybe I'll wait for the coda, the death of Michael Corleone.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in.
Thank you, Chris. We should get back to the question.
Yeah, we should. So I said I would explain what LA Takedown was in relation to Heat. So years before Michael Mann became Michael Mann, essentially. So in between Manhunter and Last of the Mohicans, there's a 6-year period where he mainly works in TV. And one of the things he does for TV is he writes and directs a film called LA Takedown, which is literally a shit Heat. It is a version of Heat. It is a TV movie. It is far less ambitious than Heat in its scope and its scale. It is 97 minutes long. It has none of the same actors except one. Sandra Berkeley appears in both versions. It stars the aptly named Scott Plank as Vincent Hanna and Alex MacArthur as not Neil McCauley, but Patrick McLaren. But otherwise, it is the same story and a lot of the same scenes as well. And then 6 years later, Warner Brothers said, hey, would you like loads and loads of money to make this with De Niro and Pacino and Val Kilmer and add an extra hour and a half onto it and make it this huge, sprawling crime epic? And Michael Mann went, yes, absolutely. And so he took his bad film and then turned it into a masterpiece. So that's what LA Takedown is. If you have never seen it, check it out. It's terrible. Absolutely terrible.
He also, obviously, he remade Miami Vice as well. I mean, he's remade his own thing twice.
I mean, he could do with remaking Miami Vice, quite frankly.
No. I will go to bat for the Miami Vice movie all day while we're on terrible opinions. If you're defending Godfather 3, I will defend Miami Vice. I think that movie is like,
there's
terrific.
There's a fundamental rule of filmmaking that it breaks, and the rule of filmmaking that it breaks is this. You don't make Colin Farrell a blonde. So I just like it's basic, you know. It's
unless Oliver Stone learned his peril.
It's up there with remember to turn the camera on and make sure that the boom is out of shot. Like you just don't make Colin Farrell blonde.
You could put Colin Farrell in a bag; he'd still be sexy.
I didn't say he wasn't sexy. I said you don't make him blonde.
He'd be fucking gorgeous.
What about if you make him enormous and unrecognizable and put him in a Batman film?
Yeah, I'm potentially upset by that, but I'm waiting and holding fire, you know.
Oliver Stone, I think, released 4 different cuts of Alexander the Great, I think.
The last one's called Alexander, this time we've got it right, honest.
No, I think there was the original release, there was the director's cut. I think there was one maybe called the longer or the extended version. And then he did make the final cut, which I don't think he's done another one since then, but maybe he will.
I mean, yeah, you know, yeah. It's never final, is it?
I can't. Have you all seen that film?
I've seen it. I haven't seen all the versions. I don't hate it.
That's Helen's poster quote right there.
Yeah.
I also didn't hate it, but neither do I have motivation to go back and see it again, especially other versions.
It's funny the films that some directors cling on to and keep insisting on trying to get us to see again, often the ones that we didn't care about in the first place.
Something that we, I think, have touched on in this podcast in the past on other questions. See, my filibustering is going particularly well, I think.
It's going really well.
Is the, you know, the special edition things, you know, obviously the obvious special editions, but so many films you wouldn't think of have alternate cuts available on DVD, like Dark City. Did you know there's a director's cut of Dark City? I bet you fucking didn't.
I bet Chris did.
Which loses the voiceover at the beginning and has a different start, and it's, you know, they change bits to it there. But so many of these films have had alternate versions, which was obviously studio cash-in on DVD. But in some of these cases, it's just they put in a few extra scenes, it's rubbish. But in some of these cases, directors have had a chance to fix things that they got wrong. You know, like there are so many. And when we did the Alien ranking, we talked about the alternate versions of Alien Resurrection, the alternate versions of Alien 3, which improved the films. While we're on this subject, when Ridley Scott was able to revisit Kingdom of Heaven and stick, what was it, another 50 50 minutes nearly back into mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. Changed it yeah. from a very flawed 3-star film to a really solid 4-star film. So he finally got to make the film he wanted to make. Kingdom of Heaven, the extended cut, is brilliant.
Well, David Ayer is lobbying to follow in Zack Snyder's footsteps and put out a director's cut of Suicide Squad, isn't he?
Yeah.
Which no one has got too excited about.
Yeah, it's I mean, it couldn't be much worse, could it? Like, it might be interesting, so.
And McGee this week said that he wants to do a director's cut, that he has a director's cut of Terminator Salvation, which he's now trying to, you know, maybe drum up some interest in.
But there was nothing good there, though. There was nothing good.
There was Christian Bale's rant against the that crew member, wasn't there? They should include that in the movie.
Yeah. It's fucking distracting!
It's fucking distracting! Oh, good for you! La-di-da-di-da-di-da! They should just include that in the movie.
That'd be amazing. Yes, truly this John Connor is a leader of men.
Yes, why has he gone British all of a sudden as well? Why is he yelling at that person? Anyway.
Chris, would you like to see the great Sam Raimi able to take another bite of the Spider-Man 3 apple?
I thought you were going to say Evil Dead 2. I was about to leap through the screen.
That's right. Make it as good as Army of Darkness.
Fuck no. You.
He made Spider-Man. Spider-Man 2 is great. And Spider-Man 3, let's be honest, is a shit show.
No, so... the Raimi film I want to see him get a chance to redo would be Crime Wave, which was his second movie and is not particularly good and had all kinds of studio interference, right down to the studio going, hey, why would you want to cast this charismatic, good-looking guy called Bruce Campbell as the lead when we can get this completely and utterly forgettable non-entity instead? I can't even remember the guy who's in the movie. But it's got some really, really lovely touches and flourishes and stylistic flourishes, as you would expect from Raimi, but otherwise it's a bit...
Didn't the Coens write that film, or am I confused?
They co-wrote it.
Coen wrote it.
A Coen co-wrote it.
Yeah, because Joel Coen got a start on Evil Dead. He was assistant editor on the Evil Dead. But yeah, Crime Wave is one of those ones where you just, you know. But then again, the fact that it flopped terribly and he had a terrible experience prompted him to make Evil Dead 2 as his next movie. So therefore, we perhaps owe Crime Wave a debt.
Do we?
Who knows? Yeah, we do. It led to the making of the greatest movie of all time. So we're all very, very happy.
I did not know that.
Which many people mistake that for a remake itself, obviously, which it is not.
Yes. What if James Cameron, the reason that he's taking so long to make Avatar 2 is because he is stealth remaking Piranha 2, the spawning or the flying killers, depending on, I think, which territory you're watching it in. So that's, in theory, Jim Cameron's first movie. Although I always discount it.
It's kind of not really, is it?
Because it's not really, like, but it kind of is, but it isn't really.
He didn't start on it and he didn't finish on it. So.
But I think they still gave him the credit, didn't they? So, ergo. Yeah. But it's one of those ones. It's like, do you count Fistful of Fingers when you're talking about Edgar Wright's filmography? He does, as he's corrected me many, many times. I go, Shaun of the Dead, it's your first movie. And he goes, no, Fistful of Fingers. I go, yep, okay, fair enough. But it was
anyway,
basically
a
student film. Yeah, anyway, let's talk about Shaun of the Dead. And it was basically a student film. So do you count that? Do you count Piranha 2?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and we know that Avatar 2 has a big underwater component. So what I'm saying is, what if he's just stealth remaking Piranha 2, only with like blue cat things?
Maybe he's stealth remaking The Abyss, which is a great film.
It is a great film.
Life's Abyss and Then You Die. Is that the one Jim Cameron film that's not available readily?
There's certainly not a 4K version of it, but I don't... Is there a proper HD version of it? I'm not sure. I think it's been broadcast in HD, but it's never been made available as a Blu-ray, to the best of my knowledge. It could have that wrong, but I don't think
I've only got the DVD.
He doesn't love that film, is that right?
He never got to finish it. Like the ending, like again, that's another one where the special edition gives you the proper ending of the film, which you don't get initially because they wouldn't let him finish the effect shots, which he wanted to do for these tidal waves. But yeah, it's great. But then that's just as a kind of like a really sort of claustrophobic, like character-driven film. It's great. Michael Biehn is fantastic in that.
So good in that.
So, so good. And with a tash that rivals Alex's for magnificence,
almost,
I have to say.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's it for this week's...
No,
I think
we're
done.
I'm throwing in another one. I'm making sure this fact section does not turn up. I'm going to say Waterworld. I would like to see Kevin Costner have another go at Waterworld because I like that film and it is deeply, deeply flawed. And I suspect it could be done better.
I don't care about seeing that film again, but I do love the fact that I think it was Peter Berg talked about when he was making Battleship, that he got a call out of the blue from Kevin Costner going, can I come in and talk to you about shooting on water? and literally came in and told him everything that went wrong on Waterworld and what he needed to do to avoid it. And I think he does this with everyone who's making a water film now, and he's like, learn from my mistakes, people.
Well, it's like a movie. People are talking in a pub going, I can't wait to shoot this movie on water, and then you hear a voice in the darkness going, I wouldn't do that if I were you. And camera pans across and there's old grizzled Kevin Costner, 95 years old, in the corner going, I remember once we did shoot on the water for the Water World and things did go wrong and we did drown the lead actress and had to replace her with a puppet for the last 6 weeks. That was terrible.
As your lawyer, let me be clear, that didn't happen on Waterworld. I think it's really important.
Those aren't my words, Helen. Those are the words of imaginary 95-year-old Kevin Costner many years from now. So,
wow.
Sue him,
having
not
made,
me.
What? So in your theory, this is 95-year-old Kevin Costner having remade Waterworld and drowned the lead actress on the remake.
Yes, obviously. I'm not saying they drowned Jean Triplehorn. Obviously, okay. She went on to do many things.
Many things.
I'm sure we could name any of them.
She's
right
flourishing
now.
Even now. Yes.
Even now, she's flourishing, alive and well, lungs unclogged with water. She is totally and utterly fine. Anyway, if you want to have your question read out in the Empire Podcast as...
And why would you?
Why would you?
Yeah.
As Edward Llewellyn found to his cost, all you need to do is get in touch with us on Twitter. That's it mainly these days. Just respond to one of my panicked tweets of a Thursday or slide into my DMs or just respond to any of my hilarious and amusing tweets with a question. And we will put it into the hat for consideration. I am, of course, at Chris Hewitt on Twitter. Okay, so that was quite a long listener question section. Oh, well done, Jimbo. Your filibustering is working. The fact section is dead for another week, but it will be back next week. It's not going to take a 3-week break, so guys, get yourselves ready. But now it is time to talk about movie news, and I guess there's only one place to start, and that is, of course, with the news that we have a new Jack Reacher. It happened last Friday, and it is happening, and it is a man who's quite tall, but does he have fists the size of supermarket turkeys? Or whatever the hell it is. It is Alan Ritchson, who can be seen in things like Titans, apparently, and is 6'3" tall, so 2 inches shorter than Reacher, so therefore I've immediately discounted him. But this is for the new Jack Reacher Amazon Prime show that they're going to do, which is the first series, or season, if you're American, is going to be an adaptation of Killing Floor, the first book by Lee Child. Jimbo, as a Reacher fan, to rival myself, what do you make of this?
My initial thought when I saw him was he felt too young for me. But as you did point out in our texting, he's what? How old is he? He's 37, did you say?
37. It's like Dennis in Monty Python and Holy Grail.
37, which you stated, without backing up with fact, but I just took your word for it, that was roughly the age of Reacher during Killing Floor.
Reacher's born in 1960. But, Killing Floor takes place in 1997. Well,
oh, it's perfect.
That seems reasonably accurate. So actually, then my one major complaint is not really a complaint. So maybe he's spot on age-wise.
Yeah.
I would need to see him in the flesh. I would have to gaze up at the slab of a man that he is to really get a feel for whether or not he is Jack Reacher. He'd need to hit me with a scything elbow, I think.
Stop a bullet with his bare chest.
Indeed. I'd need to shoot him in the chest with a 22 caliber pistol and see what happens. And if indeed his pecs stop the bullet, then yes, he can have the part. If not, it's a bit like the Salem Witch Trials.
This is how he got the part, precisely. They killed everyone else who auditioned for the role.
Their insurance bill is really high on that casting process.
I like very much the first Tom Cruise Reacher, directed by Chris McQuarrie, of course. And you can listen to the McQuarrie spoiler special if you subscribe to our spoiler special channel, folks. But I wasn't a fan of the second one.
No.
This one, it looks like this is obviously someone who hews closer to the Reacher of the book than perhaps Tom Cruise did. But I'm cautiously optimistic about this one, I have to say. Mm. I just hope that they adhere closely to the books and don't give Reacher a team of amusing sidekicks, as is the wont of these shows.
That's true. He should be, by definition, a lone wolf. Just him, his toothbrush and his passport and nothing else going on.
And his ATM card. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to withdraw money. And it'd be terrible. We'd have to watch him waste away.
Yeah, I think he'd be
very,
all right.
Very sad. Very sad.
I'm looking for... I feel like TV's not a bad place for Reacher in a weird way, just because... maybe because I binged the books as a series. I think I read the first, 15 at a go. So it feels to me like an ongoing saga that belongs on TV rather than the big screen. And I think that kind of, you know, detective-y action movie that, you know, that Reacher kind of occupies, it does work better on TV these days than on than in the movies. I feel like it's not the kind of thing you tend to see on the big screen so often, you know? And that's why you get things like the car chase, which is a really good car chase in Reacher, but it just didn't feel like Reacher. So that's what you can kind of maybe dispense with a little bit in TV. You can kind of keep it closer to the style of action in the books than the movies did, perhaps.
And of course, the movies, by their very nature, needed to be more commercial, and they were PG-13. And if anyone's read a Reacher, they'll know that he's not afraid of getting a little blood in his hands. And Killing Floor, in particular, is... Well, not in particular, because I think it killed about 475 people in the last one, Blue Moon. But Killing Floor is really gruesome, and he kills a whole bunch of people in very, very messy ways. And hopefully, not that I'm obviously a fan of on-screen violence.
No, you're not, Chris.
No, of course not. Of course not. I'm not a psychopath. What? But hopefully, that can do that aspect of Reacher justice. Mm. Although, weirdly enough, never says the F word is never uttered in any of the Reacher books.
Huh.
So he's okay with slitting people's throats from ear to ear, but or scything an elbow into someone's face and caving their cheekbones in, or crunching their noses into their brains, or punching a guy in the chest so hard his heart stops, which happens in one of the books. But the F word, no. No time for that.
There's got to be standards.
Like, yeah, everyone has their limits.
I feel like Jack Ryan's working really, really well on TV, and I think Jack Reacher is of that same type in a way, you know, so TV might actually give him more space to do what he's good at.
Although Jack Ryan did sort of stray from the path, I think, a little bit in season two, which I thought was quite boring.
That's fair, yeah.
And speaking of Reachers or former Reachers, I think we should talk about the first day of filming on Mission Impossible 7.
It's much like my first day at work.
Yeah, do you remember your first day at your new job? You come in, you know, you're given a brief tour of the office. You get to meet your workmates. You maybe have a bit of a chat with HR. Maybe there's a contract to be signed. Maybe there isn't. You know, here's a coffee machine. Here's a printer, that sort of stuff. Oh, and here's your motorbike. And there's the massive ramp and runway. And you're just going to ride off that. You'll be falling into a massive ravine. And there'll be a parachute and you'll be fine. What? Sorry? Excuse me? What? So that was basically Tom Cruise's first day on Mission Impossible 7. The maniac drove a motorbike. It was intentional, by the way. he didn't just ad-lib this. So he drove a motorbike off a huge ramp that they built in Norway and then fell off the motorbike, well, or let the motorbike go. And then you think, oh my God, Tom Cruise is going to die. Genuinely, there's footage of it. And even though I know he's okay, my heart is in my mouth. And then a parachute comes up, very much The Spy Who Loved Me. Sadly, not with the Union Jack on it. You know, not for Brexit reasons, but for Bond reasons. And then he's okay after that. That's the first day of filming. Jesus H. Christ.
Start as you mean to go on, Chris. None of this pussyfooting around, easing yourself in gradually. Just boom, do it.
Yeah,
and we're assuming it's Tom Cruise for reals, right? I mean, it hasn't been.
It
was. Was it? It looked like leaked footage. Do we know?
Who knows? They might be doing the same thing, but with because they did that, didn't they? With the A400 sequence from Rogue Nation, where
right.
You know. Word got out that it was him, so they just released footage of him being strapped to the outside of the plane as it took off and landed. Mm. And even then, people won't believe that it's him. They'll still say stunt double, so they'll still say face replacement. But apparently it is him.
The thing is, a stunt like that, you have to... Presumably he would have practiced that and rehearsed it, so he would have done it like a few times.
Yeah.
Which is even more insane.
Maybe that was the rehearsal.
Yes. Mm. Nailed it. We're good to go.
We're going straight to the dress, Tom. Straight to the dress.
Yeah. Sorry, Tom, we forgot to put film in the camera. Can you do it again? Yeah.
Well, how many times did he do the takeoff? It was 3 or 4, right? At least.
Really?
Yeah, it wasn't a one take deal.
Oh my God. I mean, he did the takeoff, the A400. Yeah, that was eight times.
Yeah.
8 times. Which is just crazy, you know. So, but I genuinely am worried about this, and I've talked to Macquarie about this on the podcast before. Tom Cruise is nearly 60, and I know that his body doesn't work in the way that our bodies work, and I know that he can still kick my ass, even though he is some years my senior. But at a certain point, the reflexes begin to dim. And basically what I'm saying is don't kill Tom Cruise and look after him and don't squash him flat.
That's all. Yes, I can get behind that as your lawyer.
That's maybe that's one of the reasons why they're doing these two films back to back, though, just to get it all in while the reflexes are still operational.
Maybe.
Yeah. God. But imagine that you're the director of that movie. You're Macquarie watching that, and you have absolute faith in Tom Cruise because he's Tom Cruise. But equally, on the last movie, he broke his ankle, and you had to like shut the thing down for a few weeks. And then you're watching them getting onto a motorbike and you're going, oh my God, what if the parachute doesn't work? What if there's a bit of wind and it blows them off the bike? Or, you know, the backup parachute doesn't work. Or presumably they had some sort of mat down there as well that he would, because he was descending at quite a rate. But yeah, just take care of him. We only have one Tom Cruise. Mm. Tom Cruise, notwithstanding, of course.
I have long said that the person we actually need to interview for these films is the insurer. I would genuinely be fascinated to know the conversations that go into making a Tom Cruise action movie.
Like, yeah, but Tom Cruise produces these films, so he can throw that in the bin and do what he wants, I guess. Make his own insurance deals that allow him to risk death.
Unless he signs like a dozen waivers.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated to know what the premiums are compared to the average person. Just, you know, there's a conversation to be had. That's all.
Chris, can you ask Macquarie what the premiums are?
Of course. I'll do it. I'll do it right away. God, can you imagine an interview with Tom Cruise's insurer? He would just be like this.
Just this haunted figure cackling like the Joker.
Anyway, it is time for James and Helen. Alex, I think you and I could take the next 5 to 10 minutes off. It's time for James and Helen to talk about the trailer for Denis Villeneuve's Dune, which finally dropped this week.
It did. It did. Although Helen and I saw that trailer some time ago, so we did get a bit of a leg up on that. Yeah. I mean, it's very good, isn't it?
It's really very good.
Did it make you feel excited, Chris? Did you feel the sand beneath your feet?
I thought it looked fine. Looks good. It's clearly well made, but then Blade Runner 2049 was well made. Boring as hell, but well made.
No, it was not, you fool. No, this was excellent. I specifically like that the still that a lot of people, and which we've gone with on the website from this, is Chalamet looking none more emo with
so
like
emo.
His shaggy hair, eyeliner, and a knife all in black. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
But yes, I thought this was great. I love the look of it. I love the feel of it. I love the chunky, if redundant, Atreides armor. I like the ornithopters that look like dragonflies.
I
like
one
the
of those.
Big ass worm. Well, Helen, when you say you flew one.
I mean, I sat in the pilot seat and I made the pedals go and the levers go. So, close as you're going to get, James. Close as you're going
to
get.
I mean, you've come closer to an ornithopter than I have, so, you
it
know,
was awesome.
That's fair.
I thought it was magic. It was, I think, so the one we saw was a rough cut. There wasn't a huge number of changes, I don't think.
No, not really.
And it was good that they kept, I wasn't sure that they'd keep in the sort of the money shot of the sandworm at the end, to which the internet's collective reaction seems to have been, bum.
Fair enough, though.
I mean, I get it. I do get it, but I'm not sure there's any other way to do a realistic sort of worm mouth.
I don't mind the kind of petaled look that David Lynch was. The one good decision he made when making that film, the petaled mouth of the sandworm actually isn't too bad.
It's actually not terrible, but this one's good.
Is it described in the books as anus-like, or is this
yes, it specifically says a giant bum hole emerged from the desert and consumed spice harvester.
There's no talk about petals in the books,
no,
so this is probably
just
closer. And I know that he and Patrice Vermette, who's his production designer, worked like for, they told us in a previous interview, for like a year on this design. So they were trying to get something really organic and really
Were there
real-looking.
A lot of cats on set
apparently,
for that inspiration? For
there were actually some cats
on
set.
This is the reverse of the cats.
Kind of is.
The bumhole cut.
Yeah, the bumhole cut of cats. But yeah, I'm super hyped. James did a very good trailer breakdown, which, unlike some other trailer breakdowns on the web that I saw, doesn't have any huge errors in it.
There's no real excuse for getting errors in something that's, you know, has been around for decades.
Well, yeah, but some people have made some assumptions which are, as far as I can tell, wrong. So I'm not. I don't want to name names because I don't want to shame other journalists. But there are some trailer breakdowns out there that are wrong right now.
It's worth pointing out that, and I'm not going to explicitly pointed out, but there is a big old spoiler in the trailer, which seemed like a very odd inclusion.
I guess I watched it and had no idea what was going on. I mean, it's probably a spoiler if you know what happens in the first place.
Perhaps.
Maybe so,
I didn't feel like anything was being spoiled.
But it's interesting their attitude to spoilers, because there were a few things in the feature that I thought might be spoilers, and then people talked about quite happily in their interviews. So I was like, okay, fine, I guess. People also criticized the trailer yesterday for sort of adhering too closely to the blockbuster trailer model, you know, big noise, ominous phrases, you know, big
giant
action
bum
scene
hole
at the end. Yeah. But I feel like if you're trying to sell something as complicated and as weird as Dune, I'm not sure you have another option on that. And I feel like this trailer, yes, it does hew quite closely to that blockbuster, you know, format, but I don't see what else you can do. I don't think you can go weird with something that's already weird.
Yeah, but also the trailers are designed to get the most amount of people into a cinema.
Yeah.
And it's marketing. It's literally marketing.
Yeah, and the directors have nothing to do with them, more or less.
No. Well, I guess some do. If you're Christopher Nolan, I think it's a very different story. But I agree with Helen. Like this film is a hard sell. The book is unbelievably dense, and it is fucking weird. And you know, it speaks volumes of the fact that David Lynch went in there, and we were discussing this earlier. It's like David Lynch made Dune, didn't make it particularly weird because it was already incredibly weird. So you didn't notice the Lynchian aspects as much.
Yeah,
exactly. It's like, oh, this is fine.
This is like a documentary.
will this work from what you guys know? I haven't read the books. I believe this is designed to work as a standalone film if there isn't a sequel for whatever reason.
Honestly, I think it will be unsatisfying if they never make the second half of this.
I'd be disappointed, but there is a break. There is a break point in the book where you have told a story.
Without massive cliffhangers, though.
Yeah, there's enough of an element of cliffhanger that you're going to want the sequel, but there's not so much that you're going to feel like you didn't see a story. Do you know what I mean? So I'm hopeful that where I think they've broken it, and I'm pretty sure of where, but you know, I don't want to make any huge assumptions, but I think there is a place there that you can make that work, and that's what I'm kind of hoping they've done. So yeah, we shall see. I do feel like pretty much what you saw of Zendaya in this trailer is about all of her scenes in this film. You know, don't let that be the only reason that you see it, but really, I mean, if you're not attracted to at least two members of that cast, I feel like you might be dead. So yeah.
Should we talk about the casting? Because by and large, Twitter received the trailer rapturously yesterday. Mm. But some people did point out the fact that this is a novel in which Frank Herbert, I keep wanting to say James Herbert, but Frank Herbert.
Very much not, yeah.
Now, he actually probably would have bum holes with teeth in his books. But Frank Herbert, you know, was inspired by Middle Eastern culture and Islamic culture when putting this together. And the cast in this does perhaps not reflect that, shall we say. You know, it's Timothy Chalamet, it's Rebecca Ferguson, it's...
Well, Timothy Chalamet's different, like, and Rebecca Ferguson as well, because they're off-world. They're not from Arrakis themselves. But certainly the Fremen, I think, are inspired by Middle Eastern cultures. That said, they're never, to the best of my knowledge, identified as people of colour in the books. It's certainly not uncommon for, you know, science fiction and fantasy novels to sort of co-opt, you know, earthbound cultures for their own needs and just take bits of them from here and there. It's not as if he was transplanting a culture. He was just using kind of, you know, nomadic desert culture tropes. I totally get it. In my head, I had always seen the Fremen as being sort of more Middle Eastern looking.
Yeah, I mean, it is a white savior narrative. And I guess the only way to avoid that would have been to make, you know, the Atreides people of color, whatever race you want to have. They have to be different, I think, or looking ideally from the Fremen. I think that's the main thing. So if you make the Fremen, you know, Middle Eastern, North African, or MENA, I think as the acronym goes, then whatever the Atreides are, they should be different to that. So yeah, I do think you can absolutely have a discussion about whitewashing, about white savior. The good thing I think about this film, and it's a huge budget, you know, major movie, is that it is at least a science fiction movie with a minority white cast. That it is mostly people of color in the cast, and that's among the Atreides retainers and so on as well. That's in the Harkonnen family as well. It's not just the Fremen.
people like?
People like, obviously, like Jason Momoa, Zendaya herself, Stephen McKinley Henderson as Thufir Hawat, people like Shannon Duncan Brewster, a character who's been gender swapped and race swapped from the book, at least. Well, her race isn't discussed in the book, or his race isn't discussed.
Chen Chang as well.
Chen Chang as well, yeah. So it's not a film that has a majority white cast, which is good. But you're right, we can absolutely have a discussion about the race in questions.
You look at Lynch's iterations and all the Harkonnens aren't just white, they are ginger. It's a very specific take on that.
That's
They're
true.
The baddies, right?
They are the baddies, they yeah. Are. Super bad.
No, it's interesting. I just wanted to see what you guys thought about that because I saw there was a discourse happening on Twitter yesterday about that.
It's relevant to kind of the broader conversation about the Oscars this week as well, isn't it? So the Oscars announced their new representation and inclusion standards for Best Picture contenders.
They're actually adopting standards here that have already been in place for BFI funding. So if you want to get funding from the BFI, you already have to meet two out of these four standards. And then that was already adopted by BAFTA initially for the Best Picture and Best British Picture categories. And it's now been widened, I think, to all categories at BAFTA. So the Oscars are very much sort of following in the footsteps of and slightly adapting to American culture as opposed to British culture, you know, slightly different ethnic minority groups and so on to consider. I think this is a very low bar to pass. So you can pass, for example, by having one lead character of color. You can pass, for example, by having for one of the other categories, by having, you know, some interns from minority groups. You can pass by having two heads of department who are women and one who is a person of color. And I mean, the heads of department include casting directors and costume, which are already female dominated. You know, it is not a difficult thing, I think, to ask that films meet these standards. And they are not onerous. They are not, I think, in contrast to art, they do not discriminate, I don't think, against anyone, because you have the option of meeting only two of them. You don't have to meet all four. And it's a really low bar. I just want to stress that. It's a very, very easy test to pass. So I think this is probably a good thing overall.
Yeah, I'm with you. The comments on the Academy's Instagram post were an absolute bin fire, as you would imagine. Lots of people claiming, you know, social justice warriors are ruining cinema. The Oscars are cancelled because they're no longer judging films on the merits of the films, but just on quote unquote woke criteria. And it's like, okay, fine, sure. That's certainly an interpretation, but none of that is true. Like, and this seems to me more than anything else as being establishing a framework for sort of best practice in the process of making movies, which is like, you know, try not to have like a wildly Aryan crew. I don't think that's hugely like onerous thing to look at. But I think, you know, you do only have to have two out of these particular four criteria met. And then, as Helen says, the bar is incredibly low. And I think anything that encourages people to maybe look at the makeups of their crew, of their department heads and whatnot is a good thing. And I don't think, and because it is two out of the four, it doesn't even need to impact what you're portraying on screen. Like, it can be an entirely sort of production-led initiative. But I think it's good working practice. I don't think there's anything really negative about this, unless you want to take it from that very Daily Mail perspective.
I think the only danger here is that it's a lot easier for studios to pass this test, if you like, than it is for independent films, because the studios can afford to pay to hire on several interns and meet that criteria immediately in a way that might be more onerous for, you know, smaller independent productions that don't have the money to hire X number of interns from different categories. So I think there is a potential here for studio films to find these easier to meet than indie films. But at the same time, you know, hopefully they can think about it early enough, act early enough, and just build it into their system, into their filmmaking.
Yeah, I mean, it is a low bar, but I guess the point is we'd probably be surprised at the amount of films that don't meet that criteria and people don't think about this at all. And just getting them to consider it is probably a big step forward for a vast amount of people.
Yeah, I agree.
Speaking of films that are almost certainly going to be eligible for Best Picture, though, Sacha Baron Cohen has apparently made Borat 2.
For my benefit, glorious cinema.
Well, apparently it's been made already, and apparently there are people in the world who don't know Borat. Is he still going out in the world as Borat and just acting as if this is not a problem? I don't... well, where is this? Where is he making it?
The question surely is, will you laugh so hard that you'll burst all the blood vessels in your face?
Is it half the blood vessels?
As famously, is it half the blood vessels?
Half the blood vessels.
But famously, Dan Jolin's Empire Review stated his 5-star review of the first film.
That, God, it's a very funny film. I haven't seen it since.
Is it though?
I haven't.
It is.
Well, not it for is, you because yeah. you don't like funny things. But yeah, as comedies go,
for the rest of us, James, yeah.
Yeah, yes. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
How it's aged. It was problematic at the time. I imagine now it would be,
yeah.
it would be run out of town with pitchforks and torches. But
well, I'm sure that'll be a scene in Borat too. Yeah,
it probably will, actually. Someone shot footage. They were driving past Sacha Baron Cohen filming as Borat the other week in L.A. We know that he's been up to stuff. We know that he's been doing stuff, but I assumed it was for his TV show. You know, Sacha Baron Cohen is a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant comic mind, and I am very excited to see what he does with this. Should it be true? It might not be true.
There were reports that the plot somehow dips into Trump and Epstein's relationship. I don't know how the hell you fit that
Yikes.
Into a Borat film.
Oh, dear God.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, Mike Pence and Rudy Giuliani have been said to feature somehow.
Oh, my God.
I mean, look.
Isn't that...
I'm always really up for seeing whatever Sacha Baron Cohen does. You know, sometimes this is not as good as other times, but he's an incredibly inventive and very funny person. So bring it on.
Bring it on. Anything else?
There is, of course, Star Trek Discovery and Walking Dead news.
Well, the Star Trek Discovery news.
There's a trailer. There's a new trailer for Star Trek Discovery, and The Walking Dead will be ending with season 11, except it's not really season 11 because they're making it 24 episodes and they're doing half of it next year and half of it the year after, which is essentially two seasons, but sure. But that makes sense anyway, because if you read the comics, we're in the last story arc of the comics. So.
I've completely forgot to mention the Walking Dead stuff, which is interesting, don't you think? Although the spin-off with Daryl and Carol. I hope it's like The Fern and Shirley. I hope it's a sitcom. But is that because Norman Reedus just does not want to cut his hair? Is that basically that they've had to accommodate him by giving him his own show?
Almost certainly.
Almost certainly. It seems
legit. Yeah.
Do you think that robs it robs season 11 of maybe some tension vis-a-vis Daryl and Carol?
I think they've known all along that if they kill Daryl, everyone riots. So.
I don't know if that's the case anymore, though.
If anyone in that show is going to survive, it's going to be him.
Oh, evidently.
Yeah.
Evidently. So season 11 is going to be a mammoth, behemoth season. What's happening with the Rick Grimes movie that was announced? A trilogy of Rick Grimes movies.
Yeah. I don't know where they are at the moment.
It all seems to have gone very, very quiet on that front.
But then Fear the Walking Dead is still going. The new Walking Dead spinoff later this year. So well beyond.
Yeah.
So there's still a lot of Walking Dead action going on, but the main story comes close. It makes sense because if they're following the arc of the comics, you have one storyline left, essentially. So I guess they'll play that out and then that will be the end of it.
But that storyline involves a character who's no longer in the TV show.
It does, but then so have so many of them. So did the most recent one as well.
Yeah.
I don't think that's necessarily a problem because, I mean, you've only got Daryl and Carol are the only two original characters still around. So they'll just recalibrate it for that. What blows my mind, and I was watching Blade 2 the other day, and I'd forgotten that Norman Reedus is in Blade 2, mm-hmm. and that looking almost exactly the same.
he doesn't really age.
He hasn't changed at all.
No.
The one I'm really excited about from that announcement is Tales of the Walking Dead, which is the sort of idea that you're going, how have they not done this before? This is such a good idea, an anthology show. It really is. It allows them to explore.
It's a terrible idea.
Why is it a terrible idea? Freddy's Nightmares with zombies. It allows them to explore, bring back different characters. So there's talk about, you know, you can maybe have a Shane episode and go way back into the past.
You can bring back
Jeffrey DeMunn, perhaps. Anyone who died, and everyone's dead, pretty much.
That's everyone, yes.
You bring them back, or you have different shows set in different parts of the world, so you don't get, you know, you're overwhelmed by the milieu of The Walking Dead shows is all very samey. No matter how much they try and change it up with Fear the Walking Dead, it all kind of comes back to the same kind of thing. So you could have a show set, you know, with scientists or the president at the time that it all starts hitting the fan. Yeah, all sorts of things. All things are possible. It might not be terrible. That's all I'm saying.
In other TV news that's really important, Jensen Ackles is getting to keep Baby, which is the car in Supernatural. He's getting to keep the A car at the end of the show.
Hang on, what does Jared get to keep?
Presumably like the B car or something. It's appropriate. It's Dean's car. Dean gets to keep the car 100%.
Hang on, it's not the same A car they've used all the way through the show, though.
Oh, they've used
it?
A bunch.
Surely.
They've got a bunch of different cars, but like he is very attached to the car. Yeah, he is very attached. He is getting like the beauty car that they use for the close-up shots. He's very, very attached to it. He's on record as saying like he doesn't even like the Teamsters driving it to the set, which legally they have to do. Like he just he can't have it, so he's getting to keep it at the end of the show.
Oh, that's
that
nice.
Seems right. Yeah.
So apparently MGM are developing a RoboCop prequel series focusing on Dick Jones.
Dick Jones!
I work for Dick Jones.
This show will delve into his backstory. Now, at first glance, you think, well, that is as unnecessary things go. There was a quote from Ed Neumeier, who is developing it for MGM, hoping to make a pilot. He was the original screenwriter of RoboCop. And there is a quote that says, it has all the cool stuff about RoboCop, except no RoboCop. So you think... Hang on a minute. So this is scraping the barrel. But then he talks about the fact that this is about Dick Jones as a corporate predator. And he says it's the story of OCP and how the world moves into the future and how the corporate world behaves. And if you think about it,
all right.
I think it's actually a really interesting landscape to explore. That sort of company, that sort of tech, those sort of backstabbing corporate shenanigans is actually a pretty rich world. And yeah, it's a very spinny spin-off without, you know, Shooty Policeman in it, but actually I think it probably is the basis for a really interesting social political action
like
series.
Future Succession, yeah. 2100 kind of thing
with killer robots in it. I mean, why yeah. not?
Oh my god, Polly's robot is in is in the Dick Jones spin-off.
Yes,
serve the public trust.
Also, given that RoboCop itself like envisaged the privatization of, you know, nursing and prisons and things like that, and that's basically all happened, it does make a certain amount of dystopian sense to discuss it right now.
I think that's what he's talking about when he says all the cool stuff about RoboCop. You do think about the satire and you think about all that very prescient stuff. So I'm actually really intrigued by this.
Amen.
We shall see. We shall see how it pans out. Maybe we'll get to see the old man as a young man. Who knows?
Yeah.
But anyway, that is it for the news section. It is time now for this week's guest, and it is one heck of a guest. It is Ewan McGregor. Yes, indeed. Obi-Wan Kenobi himself. But he's not here to talk about one of his many, many movies. Oh, no, although we do talk about some of his films, obviously. Instead, he is returning to the small screen with another series of The Long Way Show. So there was Long Way Round and Long Way Down, shows in which he drove around the world with his best friend, Charlie Borman, on some motorbikes. The last show was Long Way Down. That was 13 years ago. Now they are back for Long Way Up. A lot has changed since then. They have got older. Charlie Borman has had two massive motorcycle accidents, which means riding on a motorcycle, especially a long, long motorcycle trip, is perhaps not the best idea. But nevertheless, they did it. The show will be on Apple on September 18th. So next week, it's going to be debuting on September 18th. It is very, very good. Very, very entertaining. I heartily recommend it. And I caught up with Ewan. He was in LA. I caught up with him over Cisco WebEx, not Zoom, last week. And sound quality dips in and out a little bit. This was beyond my control, I'm afraid. But hopefully it will still be fun and enjoyable for you. Here's Ewan McGregor. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast in lockdown, of course, by the great Ewan McGregor. How are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, thanks. I'm good.
How's your lockdown been?
Oh my goodness, it's been. I've been very fortunate to be in a nice part of the world, and but it's it's been long and every day blending it like everyone else, just like everyone else's. Mm. You know, I started off doing a lot of things around the place and had lots of projects that I've been, you know, putting off for years and years, and sort of did all of those, and then slowly just started getting just one day blying into the next, you know. But I've had a lovely time with my kids and with Mary, my partner, and it's been in that respect, it's been lovely, and we've been lucky not to be touched by the actual virus or have close friends or family who have either, so we've been very lucky in that respect. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, yeah, you know, long may that continue. And have you been working? Have you been keeping your hand in the till, so to speak?
I have. I've done a few. I've done quite a lot of voice stuff. Obviously, that's what we can do as actors from our homes. And I've got a little caravan where I've set my mic up and I sit in the caravan. I did a narration for a Scottish natural history series. I did quite a lot of I did all of the work for an animation. I think it's been released now. I got in trouble for mentioning it before, but I'm voicing Jiminy Cricket in Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio. And so,
amazing.
But I did that literally from my caravan, and yeah, I always say too much about stuff, and I get in trouble later. You know, they're like, "Oh, you didn't, shouldn't, not meant to say that. You weren't meant to say you were in that." So anyway, I think it's okay.
That's good. That's out there. We know that. That's out there. There was a press release and everything. There was much rejoicing in the streets. It's all allowed? Good.
Okay, good.
How does Guillermo direct you if you're in a caravan?
Through the earphones.
Yeah.
It's kind of good. I mean, if you're, it's just sound, it's just audio anyway, isn't it? For a animation, it's just the voice anyway. So it sort of makes sense in a way, like that you can't see what you're doing. But I guess they video it. He can see you on his laptop, I guess. And I think they record that because for the animation, they try and match some of your expressions and things. It should be good. That I really look forward to that because I'm sure the animation is going to be really beautiful and interesting. You know, he's such an amazing director, and I've known him for, I remember meeting him years and years ago in New York after I saw Pan's Labyrinth and being blown away by that. And then meeting, he's such an imposing figure and one of the great directors, you know, when you meet somebody, you just know they're the real deal, and he's self-assured because he should be, because he knows his stuff. He's a real talent. I really like him.
Absolutely. And, you know, you're right. He's such an imposing figure. But when you meet him, he's such a gregarious guy and he's such a font of knowledge and wisdom. But he has this mischievous, almost filthy sense of humor as well. He's the whole package.
Yeah, yeah. He's a true, you know, there's a handful of greats and he's one of them.
And of course, I imagine you were working, you were finishing Long Way Up in post, I presume, as well. You were doing voiceover and whatnot for it also.
Yeah, we try not to do voiceovers. I've tried to record most of that on the way, you know, because we try and keep it. If we try and lift most of the voiceover stuff from the bikes, but if we can't, then we did it down there. You know, we just do it on the road as we go along.
Oh, sweet. Okay, excellent. Because I have to say, you know, I have never ridden a motorbike in my life, Ewan, because I'm just terrified of falling off. But there are moments in the show, and in fact in the previous ones as well, when you're watching you guys just buzzing along the road and it looks like the best thing in the world. And then there are moments where you're riding along a highway late at night and the rain's whipping into your faces and you look like you're this close to slipping. And I go, fuck that.
It is both of those things, though. It's true. There's moments when it's raining and it's cold. And the thing about this trip is we're not very good at the planning, Charlie and I. We're probably not very, you know, when it comes to actually decisions like when to start the journey and things like that. We might have waited a few weeks because it was still the dead of winter down there when we started. We got there and we got stuck in a hotel for 4 days because of snow. And we were thinking, okay, I don't know if this bodes well really for the beginning of the trip. We're snowbound, you know, but there was a gap on the fifth day in the snow and we just bolted out of there. But I don't know. It's just, I've loved it always. And motorcycling is that, you know, it's just the most glorious feeling, and then there's some hardship involved in it too. You know, when it's raining and cold, and everybody who rides a bike, especially in Britain, is ridden in the rain. And I don't really mind it as long as you've got the right kit on. You're all right. You know, you can ride in the rain safely. It's not like you're going to fall off every time you go around a corner. You just ride differently. You ride more conservatively perhaps in the rain, you know, but tires are good these days and stuff like that. But it's just that on a long trip when you've got to get from A to B and it's freezing and you've just got to knuckle down and do it, you know.
But it looks bloody dangerous. I mean, do you obviously doing what you do for a living, do you have to get a special insurance or is it because you're a team project so you can go, okay, we're gonna go for it?
I don't know. I mean, I think I have insurance, I guess, for myself. And then there's the production is insured. And I mean, for me, look, it's not, I think it's probably more dangerous to be riding around London on a motorbike because of traffic and cars and people, you know, at least in Britain and in Europe, there's a sort of motorcycle sense and people are aware of bikes. Riding, I'm in LA at the moment, riding here in America, you know, people have less of a sort of a motorcycle awareness, but the roads are wider and it's a bit more open out. So, but still, I think city riding is probably more dangerous than anything. You know, you can be bimbling a lot across the Sahara. It's pretty, if you fall off, you're going to fall on sand. You know, it's not that dangerous, really, which I did a lot of in our second trip. But I don't really consider it to be massive. Of course, you're more vulnerable than you are in a car, but I've just always done it. I've ridden bikes since I was in my 20s, and I just love it. It's really part of who I am, so I wouldn't change anything about it.
It's nearly persuaded me to give it a go. It looks bloody exhilarating, as
you
said.
What, and for city, I don't know where you live, but for city, you know, there's this whole new wave of electric scooters, not stand-on scooters, but like electric Vespa-type bikes, and there's a whole range of, like, two-wheeled fun to be had out there that doesn't have to be, you know, getting on a big motorcycle. You can that in a city is pretty good fun.
How does a motorbike fraternity look upon stabilizers, Ewan?
Okay, you might have to practice in a car park somewhere before and get rid of those. You might be, if you're on your little electric scooter and stabilizers, that might be a step too far, you know.
One of the great things about the show as well is the fact that, you know, this is you and Charlie getting back together again. And it's not necessarily that you've rekindled your friendship, but you do say early on that the two of you had kind of fallen out of contact. And I get that, you know, as people get older, priorities change and sometimes friendships fall by the wayside a little bit. Is that kind of where you guys found yourselves?
We did the first two trips quite close together and they're so intensive for a friend, you know, for friendship, for us, like it's all day for four and a half months. The first trip was, and you know, you're making decisions together. You're dealing with the elements together. There's the sort of stress of not getting places on time, or are we going to get there? Are we lost? All of those things is a test of any friendship, really. And we came out of them really both very well, I thought. And then it was just after the second trip, I moved to the States and, Charlie ended up doing a lot more. He made some other TV shows, travel shows on his own. And he also started doing these big rides. He goes, you know, he rides with a group of people who go and do sort of overland adventures with him in Australia and South Africa and all over the place. And so every time I would be in London working, he was just never there. He was always away. So we just sort of, we never lost touch. We were always, you know, we still called each other up now and again, but we weren't as close as we had been. And then he had this terrible accident. He was in Portugal. He was working with Triumph Motorcycles and they were launching this new bike and he was there with some journalists and he was overtaking a car and the car turned left while he was overtaking it and sort of chased him around and then it clipped him and it threw him off the bike into a wall and he broke. He really, really damaged his legs badly, broke his arm and his wrist. And he was in a terrible mess. And we got the call, you know, from somebody that works with Charlie and then managed to get hold of Ollie. And then I phoned Charlie's mobile and I got somebody answered his mobile, but it was someone from Triumph. And he was saying, oh, Charlie's in surgery. And all of us just didn't know. It was just that moment of when somebody's got really in a bad crash and you don't know quite where they are, how they're going to be, and nobody's able to tell you. And Charlie was then in recovery from that terrible operation for about from a crash for about 2 years or something. He was recuperating, and so it was certainly during that time that I just thought, you know, it was that thing where you feel like you might have lost somebody very special to you, and I just realized I can't, you know, you mustn't let these important relationships in your life drift. You know, you've got to make sure that you look after them. And it just brought us closer together again. And then whenever I was in London, I would go and see him if he was, and because of course then he was around, he wasn't traveling the world anymore because he was in a wheelchair in his front room, you know, with a bed in his living room. And he would just, he was so funny though. He was still the Charlie that we all know and love. That was one of the most amazing things about him is that he didn't sort of let it define him, or it didn't let him He just started looking forward, and it was a long recovery, but we saw a lot of each other then. Then I would stay with him when I was in London, and then Russ and Dave came over, our producers, and we started looking at maps, and then one thing led to another, and we started thinking about doing this third trip.
Suddenly you find yourselves in South America by, you know, it's like Withnell and I, we've come to South America by mistake.
What are we doing here?
We want fine wine and cakes. Perhaps you and I'm reading too much into this, but it seems to me that also you are in a slightly reflective part of your career. I mean, you know, going back to Trainspotting, for example, Christopher Robin and Dr. Sleep are both about characters kind of coming to terms with their past as well. You know, you're going back to Obi-Wan Kenobi, hopefully in the not too distant future as well. And then there's this as well, obviously picking back up with Charlie again. So are you consciously looking back, are you consciously reflecting, or am I reading far too much into it?
Oh, no. Well, I when you say it like that, it really sounds like I am. But I hadn't thought about it that way. There's a certain aspect of age that just the roles become... I wouldn't have thought do you mean Dr. Sleep because it's a sequel to The Shining, as it were?
And also, Dan Torrance is a man who's come to terms with his past.
I'm just at that age where I'm old enough. I'm old enough now to play people who have, you know, fucked up their lives and are trying to put it back together again. But I'll be 50 next year, and I think it's something to do with age. I mean, and I also think the industry is just... Well, you know, the industry is making films that they just want people to go to the... Well, not people are not going to the cinema at the moment, but they want people to watch films to make money. And so therefore they think, well, if we keep making sequels to films, the product name is already out there, then, you know, so newer ideas, newer original stories are harder and harder to find. There's just the whole industry is sort of awash with sequels and films based on other films, and it just seems to be the way it is at the moment.
Absolutely. That's a fair point.
But the Star Wars thing is different. The Star Wars project's different in that it's been a long time coming in terms of me speaking with them about it and now sort of in development with them on it. And it is, I don't know. I think it's true to say that I'm sort of more excited about doing this one than I'm more excited about doing this one than I was doing the second and third one that we did before. Because I'm just excited about working with Deborah and Deborah Chow, and the storylines are going to be really good, I think. And I'm excited to play him again. I don't know. It's been long enough since I played him before, and for me to sort of also appreciate the you know, our films came out and they weren't much liked when they came out by the people who, my generation, who loved the first ones. I think the people of our generation wanted to feel the way they'd felt when they saw those first three movies when they were kids. And George wanted to take our ones in a sort of different direction. He had a different idea. And I don't know, it was tricky at the time. I remember... But now, this all these years later, now I'm really aware of what our films meant to, you know, the generation they were sort of made for, which was the children of that time, and they really like them. So I've met people who really, they mean a lot to them, those films, you know, and they more so than the original three. And I'm like, are you kidding? But they really like them, and so I don't know. I feel like I'm more excited about it in a way. And I've also, you know, there's that young British sort of cocky, swaggery 90s bullshit that we all had. And I've sort of grown up a bit, you know, and it was cool to be sort of not into that kind of, you know, the big Hollywood. It was cool to sort of be dismissive of it at the same time doing it, you know. So, And now I'm just much more even about the work I do, and I loved doing the Christopher Robin movie because it's nice to do films. I loved that film because it was my friend Mark who directed it, and he's got such an interesting sort of take on things. And we made a film that was a Winnie the Pooh film, but also quite had bleakness in it.
It was dark.
It was dark all over the place. Yeah, and about a man struggling to find himself and. And I just loved that he was able to do that. And I've watched that. I watched that film with all of my kids in different places. I remember watching it with Clara and Esther, who are, you know, Clara's in her 20s and Esther's 18. And we watched it in New York City. And then I watched it with my 9-year-old here in LA in the afternoon. And I watched it with Jamian. I forget where I watched it with Jamian, but it felt like a different movie every time I watched it with a different age group or a different one of my different children or different time of the day. It was very interesting how he managed to do that.
It's really dark. It's a man having a nervous breakdown, but with Winnie the Pooh, by his side.
Yeah. So the fact that that's, you know, I've been a dad for 24 years, and I like the fact that you can work and do good work for children to enjoy. Well, I mean, why not? So the fact that we can do this Star Wars series, I'm also really excited about. And again, I'm terrified. I'm going to say too much. I don't know what I'm. I'm now just sitting here thinking, what am I meant to say? What am I not meant to say? But I think some of the technology that we're going to use is going to make it more exciting to shoot than the first three I did were really at the very beginning of digital photography. Yeah. Like we had a camera with an umbilical cord to a tent. It was like back to the beginning of movies, you know, where everything was, the camera didn't move very much because there was so much hardware attached to it.
Amazing.
But now we're going to be able to really create stuff without swathes of green screen and blue screen, which becomes very tedious for the actor.
I know you can't say anything about what you're going to do as Obi-Wan Kenobi, Ewan, but can you tell the people, the fans, that we will see Ilan Sleaze-Bagano, who is the guy who tries to sell Obi-Wan death sticks in the bar in Attack of the Clones? I want to know what happened to that guy.
Well, I would imagine he's probably not with us anymore because he was a real... He's probably died of lung cancer somewhere along the line. But I know I don't want to say because I don't know. Maybe we'll bring him back. I don't know. Maybe he should be in a hospital or something, or going by in a sort of hover wheelchair, wheezing away, you know?
You don't want to sell me death sticks. That's what he says. He says, I want to sell you. You want to buy some death sticks? That's what he says.
But, I remember his face as you say it. You're very good at him.
Oh, thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much. I'm sure you're equally good at Obi-Wan, by the way. But Ewan, it's been a pleasure, sir.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, man. Take care.
Cheers, mate. Take care.
That was Ewan McGregor. And yes, indeed, Long Way Up is available on Apple Plus or on Apple TV next Friday, September 18th. Check it out. And I cannot wait for him to return as Obi-Wan Kenobi. But now it is time to talk about the movies that you can watch, some in cinemas, some on your Sofaplex, this week. And we're going to start with a film that is out in cinemas and actually opened last week. We're going to start with Les Miserables, which is not an adaptation of the musical, which must have been a huge disappointment to James Dyer. But what is it? Tell us about this movie, Jimbo.
I have to be honest, this did take me rather by surprise. I thought the songs were disappointing. I thought Jean Valjean was horribly miscast. It just wasn't really what I want from an Andrew Lloyd Webber adaptation on any level.
It's not an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical.
Is it not? Who's it? Oh, no, you're right. It's not. It's...
Oh, my God.
It's not at all. Well, that explains why it all went wrong. Yes, no, this, of course, isn't. Helen, I'm going to need your help with a little bit of pronunciation. This is the new film from, how do you pronounce it? Lajli,
I guess. I'm not sure.
Lajli, famously a documentarian. But this is, to all intents and purposes, a French training day in many ways. And it focuses around a new sort of rookie cop called Stéphane, which is Damien Bonnard. And he's transferred to this anti-crime squad, Les Bosquettes, which is a little bit like a cross between Alonzo Harris's crew and Vic Mackey's crew from The Shield. And they work an estate in eastern Paris. In fact, it's set in Montfermeil, which is where Les Mis is set. And it does reference the Victor Hugo story as well. Although, I cannot emphasize enough, this is not a modern-day reimagining. But essentially, these three cops go about their day and try and deal with the sort of melting pot of Roma carnival people there. There's a black community. There's the Muslim Brotherhood in there. There are a lot of different factions. It's a bit sort of like the temperature is literally rising, so tempers are fraying. And in many ways, it's kind of police versus the local inhabitants of this estate. But it's shot beautifully. It's got a real kinetic camera work in it. There's a lot of handheld and it's a lot of drone footage, both as part of the plot and also part of the filmmaking technique. This film has so much energy to it and it's so bold and it's it has an awful lot to say, obviously, about the social strata of this environment that it's in, but it's just really, really well put together. I was completely enthralled from this from top to bottom, and I really didn't expect to be honest, because, again, I can't emphasize enough, there aren't any songs in it. But really, really, really good. This was I want to say, what festival? Was it Venice? No, it was Cannes. It was Jury Prize at Cannes. Mm. Jury Prize at Cannes, I want to say, last year. But really, 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 really good.
Yeah. It's taken a long time to get here.
It has taken a long time to get here. But, and I didn't, you know, I'm not familiar with any of the actors in this. I've not seen any of them before. Damien Bonnard looks a lot like Michael Imperioli, but other than that.
It's taken a longer time to get here because of COVID. It was supposed to be out a few months ago, to be fair.
I think Bonnard is probably the closest thing to a star in it, although if there's any justice, then Jibril Zonga would become a star after this. I think he's extraordinary as Guada.
He's very good, yeah.
I love this. It has real, real echoes of La Haine, which is, of course, also on re-release recently. But it feels like there's a huge debt in some ways to La Haine, or maybe it's just a similarity of place and of subject matter. But it really, really does recall that. But it also has elements of Do the Right Thing, just in terms of the rising temperature and the rising tension and the way that it sort of builds and builds as it goes. Also, really impressive performance from Issa Parika as Issa, who I assume is a newcomer, but he is he's just incredible here.
Yeah, he's one of the kids. Yeah. Also, shout out to Alexi Menenti, who plays Chris, the kind of Alonzo Harris character, who's a slightly racist, unpleasant coffin. he's pretty racist, but again, he's hateable, but really nails that performance.
Yeah, he does. It's the best of the films, I think. Well, Painted Bird is pretty good too, but
yes, indeed. So we gave this one 4 stars. In fact, spoiler alert, we gave everything 4 stars this week. So Les Miserables, 4 stars for that. And next up, we have the return of the brilliant director, Sally Potter. Sally Potter! She is indeed the chosen one. She has survived battling Voldemort. She's back with another movie. It is The Roads Not Taken. Helen Idaho, please tell us about this movie.
Yeah, this is an interesting one from her. It's very personal, I think, to her. So she nursed her brother through early onset dementia. And I think this is a sort of a way to work through that experience, that wrenching loss of someone when they're right there with you. But Javier Bardem plays a man who is kind of disappearing within himself. Elle Fanning is his daughter. And she's it's a normal day. She's trying to basically take him to the dentist and the optometrist and then home again so she can get to work. That's sort of the plot to the extent that there is. And he is not so much there as he is off in his own head, imagining what life might have been like if he'd stayed with his childhood sweetheart, who's played by Salma Hayek, or if he'd left his family, if he'd left Elle and her mother, Laura Linney, when she was born and gone off to be a writer in Greece. But all of his sort of fantasy life and real life keeps sort of becoming imperfect. Grief keeps creeping in, imperfection keeps creeping in, and it feels like he's falling apart on the inside. And on the outside, you have Elle desperately trying to connect with him, desperately trying to look after him, just being having this real bond, trying to make this bond with him. She feels incredible love for him, and she's trying to sort of hold on to him as long as she can. So it's really moving in that sense. But it's not an easy film because it is pretty bleak in some ways. You know, he's not going to come back from this. There's no getting through it. There is only sort of that gradual decline. Yeah.
Really is. But the performances are great, aren't they? I mean, they're just
fantastic, as you would expect from Sally Potter and from all of this cast. Yeah.
Yeah. And unsentimental, I thought.
Very much so. Yeah. Yeah. It's not always an easy watch, but it is one that is worthwhile. It is a very human story.
Absolutely. We gave this one 4 stars as well. As I said, we gave everything 4 stars this week. The Road's Not Taken, that is out. It's going to be out in cinemas this weekend, as indeed is Les Miserables. And as indeed is The Painted Bird. I think The Painted Bird is also available digitally as well. In fact, they probably all are. Go and check them out. So this is The Painted Bird, and this is another 4-star one. And this is a near 3-hour black and white treatise on the horrors of war. So naturally, Alex Godfrey, the man with the tash, it falls to you to tell us about this movie.
Yes, talking of bleak and not easy, this is, I mean, oh my God. I mean, I've seen this. I absolutely completely love this film because it's beautiful and completely captivating. But this is as horrific as things get. I mean, it's 1940s Eastern Europe, and it's basically a young boy being run out of town and then another town and then another town. And the horrors that are thrown at him are just basically the worst things that you can imagine happening to a human. And this is a boy. I mean, look, it begins with him being chased. It opens, he's being run around. His pet ferret is being urinated on. It's then set onto fire and burned to death. That's the beginning of the film. And it goes, it gets worse and worse and worse and worse from there for 2.5 hours until it finishes.
Yeah.
You're really sold yet?
I mean, as I was watching, I wrote, this is a biblical coming of age in hell. I mean, it's really insane. There are images in this film that you will not forget if you can even bear to watch them. I mean, he's buried up to his neck in the ground while crows peck away at his blooded head. There's a cat licking out a gouged out human eye. I mean, Udo Kier is in it, which should set off some alarm bells in itself. He's absolute terror on legs in this film. You know, there's a shot of him just sitting there getting quietly furious while in the background two cats have sex, and it's terrifying. You know, a village is pillaged. It's extraordinary, but you kind of really, really feel it. It's beautifully shot in black and white. It's very, very painterly. It is genuinely gorgeous to watch. I think it's very lyrical. There are flawless uses of contrast and lights and light and shadows. And even though you're just seeing this cavalcade of horror, you kind of, I don't know, it's not like a human centipede thing. It's there's something detached about the way it's filmed, but there's something very emotional about watching it. And it's kind of, I mean, I don't want to give away what it's really about, but despite everything I've just said, it doesn't feel gratuitous and it doesn't feel exploitative. And you really feel for everything that's going on. And by the time it finishes, I felt a real catharsis and sadness about it. And I know a lot of people think it's just too nihilistic and too nasty, but I mean, that's not what I took from it. Helen, what did you think?
Yeah, I think there's enough kind of beauty and maybe, well, hope is a strong word, but something in it, there's enough feeling in it that you can kind of get through it. But you could almost, I mean, apart from the straight up horrors, you could frame any shot in this film and it would be incredible. Like, looking, it is, as you say, absolutely beautiful. And I think that does help you watch it in some ways, like almost like it gives your eyes a rest every now and again in a strange way. And again, great performances. I mean, not just Udo Kier, but you've got Stellan Skarsgård in there, Harvey Keitel in there, playing very much against type for him. It's an extraordinary film. I don't ever want to sit through it again, but I'm glad that I watched it.
I did sit through it again.
We haven't mentioned the director.
I mean, it's directed by the Czech Republic's Václav Marhol. Forgive my pronunciation. I mean, it's adapted from Jerzy Kosinski's 1965 novel. There was some controversy about that because it was claimed at the time to be autobiographical, since, I think, debunked. But I don't know if that's important when you watch the film. It's a brilliant story. And there is so much evil in this film. And when there are glimmers of goodness and people being kind to him, it's such a relief.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary piece of work.
Yes, indeed. We gave this one 4 stars then for The Painted Bird. And that is it. On that optimistic, uplifting note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by the director and star of one of my favourite films of the year, the incredible British movie Rocks. So that's Sarah Gavron and Bucky Bacrae. It's an incredible, incredible film that I heartily recommend. And that's going to be on next week's show. But until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from Helen Idaho.
Toodaloo.
It is goodbye from the man with the tash, Andre Sitar. Why have you called yourself Andre Sitar, Alex?
Because I had 5 seconds. I haven't used Squadcast in ages. It said, what's your name? I thought, I don't know, something from Tenet, but something hilarious, and it didn't work.
Hilarity and Tenet did not go well. You know, you can't mesh your hands together when you're doing that.
No.
It is goodbye from Inspector Chauvert, James Dyer. And it's goodbye from me, Chris Hewitt. I'm off to do a massive jump off a motorcycle ramp. Hopefully you guys have packed a parachute for me, right?
Sure.
Okay. Sounds good. I'm all on board. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.